In this episode of Selling Isn't Everything, you're going to have the opportunity to hear from the great storyteller, Don Yeager. Now, there's storytellers and there's story extractors. And Don Yeager is the story extractor of the century. He has interviewed everyone from Shaquille O'Neal to LeBron James, his mentor, John Wooden. But more importantly, not just the 50 books that he's written or all the incredible interviews he's done. When you're done with this podcast, you'll not only know how to tell better stories, you'll know what it's like to be a better human. Because Don Yeager is exactly that human. Let's go. Don, you're officially our first podcast guest.
That's a scary thought.
Right? It's just strange because between your books and your own podcast, you get millions of views. And so I told you, Don, I'd like you to be our podcast guest. And we have an audience the size of which you've never seen before.
Of UNO.
Just the O.
Zero followers. Yeah. Will you be our first guest? And you said yes.
Absolutely.
I mean, what could possibly go wrong? It's kind of a no-risk agreement. So appreciate you, Don. Thank you.
Now, for those of you listeners who don't know Don Yeager, you've been living under a rock. First of all, I'm going to tell you what ChatGPT said about you. Okay, Don?
I've not ever done that.
You've interviewed everyone from Condoleezza Rice to Michael Jordan, Walter Payton, the CEO of Disney, Delta, Chick-fil-A, and Bank of America. You were mentored by John Wooden. You've written 35 books, 12 of them New York Times bestsellers. You're a leadership coach, a podcast host, and oh yeah, you used to write for a little company called Sports Illustrated. I know Brent's very excited to ask you questions about that. You've reported from places like Baghdad and Afghanistan, but that is not why I asked you to be our first guest.
Now I want to know what it is that I did in my not so illustrious career to earn this honor.
This honor of this huge audience. So it was about 6 months ago, and you and I were sharing a stage, doing keynotes, but I was the backup band. You were like the main attraction. And I heard you were going to be there, and I asked the host, I said, can I come a day early? I've got to see Don Yeager speak, because I heard all this hubbub about you. Oh, and you worked with Simon Sinek, and the list just goes on and on, right? So I came in a day early to see you and to meet you, and I was just blown away by how nice you are. I'm like, this guy is a good human being. And we had a drink together. We talked. You asked me all these questions about me. You just made me feel important and wonderful. And I just thought, this is an incredible human being. So that's why we wanted you to be first on our show. So thank you.
Well, thank you. What an honor. And yeah, it was an incredible honor when you shared that you had come in a day early to listen. So I was taken by it. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, I want to start. There's a phrase in Hawaiian culture, let's talk story. It's not really about performing, though. From what I understand, it's about connecting. And I know you grew up in Hilo. And I wanted to ask you, is that where your gift started of drawing out stories in other people? When Brett and I were collaborating on this and talking about what we want to talk to you about, we thought, he's an incredible storyteller. He's an incredible storyteller. And Brett said something great. He said, actually, I believe Don is an incredible story extractor. Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to know, did your growing up in Hilo impact that? Was there something else? How did you learn to do that?
Well, it is a childhood thing, but I would argue that it was because I'm the son of a preacher. My dad was a preacher, and he, he used to argue that the best communicators are always storytellers, and the best storytellers are always the best listeners. And too often we think of storytelling as an art of action. Sometimes it's about inaction. It's about sitting back, asking a question, and learning. And if you can learn enough about someone else's story, that then you could repeat it in a short form, right? In a way in which somebody is now attracted to the person you just learned from, what you become is this kind of conduit of, and stories become kind of the coin of the realm. And it's, for me, that was the thing I watched my father do really masterfully. And I watched him pay attention as he listened to people. He was a very intentional listener, not an active listener, but an intentional one, which meant he wasn't thinking about his next question while he was listening to you. He was just listening to you. And that if he, when you paused, he would come up with a question. It wasn't like the crafting of it was happening in his head, which meant he was ignoring you. And that intentional listenership that I watched him practice became a really important part of kind of who I was. And I think you can find the best stories in Brent. Thank you very much. I think that is what I hope to be known for one day, not as a storyteller, but as a story collector, right? Just that if I can extract them from other people, that's the greatest gift somebody can give me, is to trust me with their story.
So your father was a preacher. I imagine he was very busy.
Mm-hmm.
Did he listen to you as a child? Because I often hear stories of what they did professionally isn't what our relationship was personally.
Well, I probably am a lot like most. I know a lot of other preachers' kids who would agree with me in this assessment. There was a lot of anxiety in our household, and there was a lot of friction between my father and I for many years, because it always felt like when things were going wrong in our house, he was busy down the street trying to solve somebody else's problem when we needed him at home. And that was a point of resentment. It took me years to get through that with him and to come to an understanding that that's just who he, that was what he was called to do, right? And I had to accept that. But yeah, there was friction as a kid. And, but I would tell you, he was one of the greatest, he's probably the greatest influence on my life, even for all of that.
It's interesting, Don. It's a little bit of the cobbler's children, isn't it? It's funny because, and I can say the words cobbler's children to you when you say that, right? Because you know exactly what I'm talking about, right? Which is, this is,
no shoes,
it's right. It's like, you know, the shoemaker's children are running around with no shoes on. And it's the the reason I mention this, because this happens all the time, doesn't it? Whether in your family or just in general, you know, I used to work at a company where we would write best practices for other companies. We travel over the world, teach other companies like all these great best practices. You look inside our own company, it's like, wow, this is the most dysfunctional place I've ever been, right? And, but, you know, whether it's at the company level, at the individual level, at the family level, I would imagine, because you spend a huge amount of your time traveling all over the world, writing books that are incredibly well received, sharing lessons learned, ideas on how to, I don't want to put words in your mouth so you can sort of characterize it, but around whether it's greatness or leadership or just leading a better, more positive life. I wonder if sometimes you just look in the mirror and think to yourself, like, I need to take my own advice. I just like, because I would make that, I would imagine that would make you a human being. You're like a normal person. I don't know.
I think that's very true. And I think, you know, to the cobbler's children example, you know, I have so many friends like Sherry and others who are in the speaking world who, you know, when it's time for me to try to get something through to my own teenagers, I could do it all day long. They will not hear me. They have zero idea why anybody else listens to me. But I can weave some friend into the conversation and they'll say the exact same words I will say. And boom, my kids will go, what wisdom. How amazing that you have these friends. Dad, you're so lucky. I'm going, you just shut up and listen, kid. You know? Anyway.
Well, let me ask you, we brought up kids. Let me ask you something, because I'd love to go back and just get a little bit more context for those who may not know you and your incredible body of work. When you're maybe, because this is how it goes down in my house. So I'm on my own as an independent right now. I've just written another book. We're going to go out and do training on it. I'm a researcher, I'm a writer, I'm an author, I'm a speaker, all that kind of stuff. But when my kids, I have a high school, my younger one's now in high school, and she says, Dad, my friends were asking me the other day, what you do for a living? And I don't know what to tell them. And I looked at her and said, I don't know what to tell them either. I mean, what do you do in your mind, Don? Like when someone, what do you do? What do you do? I mean, I know what you do. I know the paper resume, but what do you do?
So my kids have had that same conversation. Well, you know, Sophie's dad is a lawyer, and you know, and Jimmy's dad is a doctor. And when I get asked, I'm like, my dad tells stories.
Yeah.
And everybody goes, and he gets paid for that? And you know, and then my kids are able to convince them that I somehow make a living, which is good.
Because that's what it's funny you say that, because that's what I land on too. It's like, I'm a storyteller.
Different forms, different fashions, whether it's, you know, on my podcast, or whether it's on, you know, a stage, or whether it's in a book. My goal is to tell a story that will make you turn to the next page.
What kind of stories do you like to tell?
I love to tell stories of people that I think are misunderstood. Those are my favorite people. People that maybe some have an opinion of them, or some might look at a set of circumstances around someone and assume certain things. And if I can get in and understand that person well enough, then maybe I can help them explain themselves to people in a way that might reverse the trend that others have about them and what they've been through, and maybe create some context. I love to tell the stories of people who are misunderstood.
So, Don, obviously, that I think that all the listeners want to know, and I certainly want to know, because, right, I mean, you've interviewed everybody from Walter Payton to Michael Jordan, all these famous people. I think everyone would love to know, who is a person that was so misunderstood that when you dug deeper and asked them about their story, even you were surprised and you sort of got like chicken skin, like, wow, I never knew that.
I would tell you, I mean, I did a book last year, it came out last year with Deion Sanders, the coach at Colorado, you know, legendary baseball player. You know, and he's a person that many people have very strong opinions about one way or the other. And frankly, I did too when I was engaged to begin writing with him, and wasn't sure I was the right one, wasn't sure it was the right fit for me. And then within 30 minutes, he and I are in a place in his life that is so dark that you wouldn't even imagine that somebody of his fame will have had to go there. And as he's sharing it with me, and it was a suicide attempt. And I realized, you know what, nobody knows these things about these folks, because too often that doesn't play on social, right? That doesn't work for the world. And so most people don't go there. And if I can create the atmosphere where he's safe and he'll share it, and then I can recreate the atmosphere for readers in a way that is safe for him as well, I get to help people understand who he is. And it's it was enormously meaningful.
I'm so grateful that you brought that up. I was thinking this morning as I was preparing for this interview about what I really want to know about you and about how you work. And I thought something that I have always struggled with, you know, when you become more of a public figure, you've got a social media following, you're, you know, doing keynotes, all the things that you and I do and Brent does. I was thinking, you know, there are things in my life that I've wanted to talk about, just because I think that as humans and as speakers, it almost feels maybe inauthentic not to talk about a real struggle, not the struggle that you sort of contrive and, oh, I'll tell this story about this struggle and then this great thing happened, because we all have those, right? We all have our hero stories that are very carefully crafted. And then there's those things that I think we all have at this point in our life that are dark, things that we're ashamed of, things that are scary for us to even talk about to our best friends. Mm-hmm. And I guess what I wanted to ask you is, how do you draw that line for yourself? Because I feel like as a speaker, it almost feels like false advertising sometimes if we don't talk about those things. And then, you know, all the experts will say, oh, no, that doesn't play well with your ICP, right? Microsoft doesn't want to know that you blah, 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 you know, fill in the blanks. And I was very curious and wanted to get there, but you got there sooner than I probably would have. But how do you navigate that? Or is that not an issue for you?
So I'm a cancer survivor, right? And it was an emotional set of circumstances that happened when I was in my early 40s. I actually have one speech in which I have one line where I make a reference to the fact that I had cancer, but that I am today cancer free. And I have so many people come up afterward like, man, I wish you'd talk more about that. But I'm literally just told you I'm today cancer free and it makes me cry, right? Like if you're a cancer survivor, as you may know, every year you're screened and every year it takes them 2 weeks to tell you that you're still cancer free. And they're the worst 2 weeks of your year. And so, yeah, that's one of those places where I try to be a little authentic by offering that. Then I realize I can't go too far because then I'd be a babbling idiot standing on a stage if I had to dig deep into the conversation about what going through cancer treatment was like. For all these years later, I'm still not ready to go there.
In many ways, the whole point of this podcast is to explore sort of the human side and the human connections of the sales profession. So Sherry and I, of course, spend all of our time working with sales and marketing organizations around the world, trying to help them go to market more effectively. But she and I deeply believe and very sincerely believe that at the heart of all of that effort is really human connection and creating better, stronger, higher quality, for lack of a better word, human connection is... If you want to be, it's a better way to sell more stuff. I mean, if you want to go there, fine. But we think it's just a better way to live a more fulfilled career life and frankly, to be more successful. So one of the things that we're so interested in doing in this podcast is bringing on people like you who are in all sorts of different ways, have deep expertise in building and sharing and thinking about human connection and then seeing how that ties back into the sales world. And so I want to do that in a minute with you and explore that. But just since we're on it for a second, there's this really interesting thing about, first of all, your story of my wife's also a cancer survivor, so I can somewhat vicariously, but nonetheless somewhat directly, completely relate to your story, and I completely understand exactly what you're saying. There's another side of just like this be your authentic self, which is, I don't know, it feels almost like it's like id and super ego type stuff. Like we're going to get kind of Freud. It's like, no, be your authentic self, but not that authentic. You know what I mean? It's like, sometimes I show my authentic self. It's like, no, dude, that was a little too authentic for my taste. So there's breaks on these things too, aren't there?
Right. It's like the vulnerability hangover, you know, right? There's these buzzwords, right? Be authentic, be vulnerable.
Be yourself.
And then, somebody and you're like, yeah, I think I like.
Yeah, I could have lived without that detail. Yeah,
right.
No, it's a fine balance, and that's why I thought I would ask that question because, you know, you're sort of confronted with that all the time when you're a public figure, and you want to be that authentic self, but then you also have to think about what you're putting the audience through, right? Like, everybody needs to go there, and certainly they don't need to see me. Depending on the group, I mean, I was with a women's group one time, and I just authentic, vulnerable stuff I'd never talk about in a podcast, but it works. So I do think it depends on who the audience is and why you're there and all of those things. And like Brent said, we are looking at bringing a lot of people in that aren't necessarily sales gurus, but really understand the art of connection. I always say to sell more, you have to first be more. And again, that was the attraction I had to you.
Thank you. You said you sell people, but you know, authentic connection. I think the two are inextricably linked. I think to sell more, you do have to create authentic connection. And if this world is done with transactional, relationships, I really do believe that. I think I don't think people gravitate to those anymore at any level. And I don't think this is generational. I don't think this is, we have to worry about the Gen Zs and the millennials. No, this is who we have become. And I think if you are, if you're not willing to work at creating connection, and that's what, and it is work, right? Anybody who says it's not is fooling themselves. If you're not willing to do that work, you can't sell. You can't sell unless you happen to have the only product that does what somebody needs, you know, and by the way, that won't last for long in this world either. Then you better learn how to create connection, and creating connection is an art form.
You know, I was talking to someone at one of these big, well-known, huge companies that we all know that is particularly investing in AI and agentive and all that kind of stuff. And and even they said something really interesting. They said here at our own company that we spend all of our time talking about how AI is going to offload, you know, repetitive tasks, thus freeing up humans for higher value activities. He said, you know, the funny thing is we never really sit around and define what we mean by higher value activities. Like, what does it actually mean? And I think that to me is sort of, I don't know if the hill I'll die on, but certainly the hill I want to climb for the next 5-10 years is to be, you know, not that we haven't all as a species been doing this for millennia, but like, what does that mean? Well, you know, what does human interaction look like? And what is uniquely human about interaction today in a world where, frankly, machines can do so much more than they could in the past? And so one of the things that I've landed on that I think is really interesting goes back to where Sherry started the conversation. So, among many other things that you do and are great at, you're a storyteller. So storytelling is something that comes up in sales a lot. So being, you know, I did a podcast about a year and a half ago where someone said, Brent, you're a well-known storyteller. Help our people tell great, help our audience, which is all sales professionals, tell better stories. And sort of thinking about what I might say and the advice I might provide and the experience I've had, it occurred to me that when I think of like the best interactions I've had with clients and audience members, particularly one-on-one, it's not when I'm telling stories, but when I'm helping them tell their story. It's when I'm getting them to share something. And it creates, and when I'm creating the space, exactly as you said, I think to open up and share something from their perspective. Now, in my purpose, it might be something about their organization, how they're trying to do something. You might be something much more deeply, personally profound. But I've never really sat down to figure out how I do that, or even if I do that well, but clearly you do it extremely well because you've turned it into not just a career, but something really beautiful. It's a sort of off the top of your head sort of thing, maybe, but advice, how does one think about this? I don't know if extraction is too sort of almost hygienic, but this idea of how do I get people to share their stories? Any tips or thoughts that would make someone effective in doing that, particularly in a sales, you know, in a sales environment? I've never met you before. Maybe I've got, you know, I think what you said about Deion Sanders is really beautiful. It's like within 30 minutes. It's like, okay, now what's in within 90 seconds version of that?
I teach storytelling as well, as I know Sherry does, and as I know you do too, Brent. But one of the things that that I've learned over the years that I think is the greatest, I think there are two places where most storytellers fail if they're trying to tell stories of impact, right? Stories of meaning. And the first is they don't know their audience. They don't know who they're telling the story to. Mm-hmm. In my opinion, in this day and age, if I know I've got an appointment this afternoon with Joe Smith at Capital City Bank to do something, if I haven't invested time if I haven't invested a few minutes to get to figure out who Joe Smith is, in this day and age, that's malpractice, right? I mean, yeah. I think you should get sued for not doing the work, right? If you don't show up well prepared. And so I actually have argued for many years, I've kind of taught this lesson as well, that I think there's a series of concentric circles that work in the ability to kind of create the open door for your story to be heard better, or your questions maybe to be reacted to differently. And the outer circle is straight up research, right? What do you do? What do you know? What can you learn about people that you're getting ready to spend time with, and that you're getting ready to either learn from or share something with? I do that, as I'm sure both of you do, with my audiences in advance. I ask for, you know, I ask for a list of names of people who are going to be in the room, and I'll dispatch a couple of interns. I'll do some work myself, and I'll spend a couple hours preparing to know who's sitting in the room, right? What do I know about them? And so that's that outer circle. Then the next circle is creating some level of connection based upon that information. So, you know, if I can know that someone went to UCLA, right? We talked about John Wooden. If I happen to know that based upon some research, I might, you know, make sure to let them know that I know they went to UCLA. And by the way, I've spent a lot of time on the campus. I loved my time with John Wooden, right? So outer circle, I get to know a little about them. Second circle, I share a little about what we have in common, right? Mm-hmm. And that brings you to that center circle, which is the opportunity to ask a question you might not otherwise get a chance to ask, or to even share a story that you might not, or have your story heard differently, right? Heard more actively because they understand that you actually are someone of interest to them. I argue all the time, nothing makes someone more interested in you than when they find out you've taken time to show interest in them. So yeah. If I've invested a little bit of time in learning something about you, then I've found a point of connection between us. And then that brings us to that center circle where I get to do, I can make my story more effective for people. And so I'm constantly thinking, who am I talking to? What can I know about them? What do I have in common with them that will make me more attractive to them, right? Oh, wow, mm-hmm. That guy's standing up there, but we're in the same, we have this in common. And then that brings us to the third level. When I teach that, often I share an opportunity I had a number of years ago I was invited to spend a day with Michael Jordan. And the day I was spending with him was his 50th birthday. And he had invited a handful of a small group of reporters who he knew to kind of get a chance to spend the day writing a story about half a century of greatness, right? I've interviewed him before, could have been the same as every other interview. I decided to just dig in. And much as I knew about him, I wanted to see what more I could learn. And I found, you know, that Michael Jordan had a very strained relationship with his father.
Mm-hmm.
His father thought that Jordan was a game-playing fool because he thought Jordan should be focused on work and not playing games all the time. And so I decided in my conversation with him to share that I had a strained relationship with my own father. And we talked a little bit about dads, and we talked about, in this very small way, we had something in common. I'm never going to have anything else in common with Michael Jordan other than the fact that we both struggled to gain and keep our father's attention and affection, and we both often failed to reach that.
It's a kind of vulnerability, isn't it, that you have to be willing demonstrate, I guess, right?
Right. So that led me to ask Jordan a question that he would later say, in all the interviews he'd ever done, he'd never answered this question. I asked him, I said, Michael, you know, given your relationship with your father, was there ever anything he said to you that left a scar that you still think of today? And often when I'm teaching this, I'll then play the recording of what Jordan said to me next. And you hear our conversation in which he tells the story about being a 10-year-old little boy trying to get his dad's attention and affection. His dad's working on a car out in the garage. And so Michael's out there just trying to get his dad to pay attention to him. The dad calls on Michael to hand him a wrench. And Michael doesn't know what a 9/16 wrench looks like. And he hands him the wrong wrench. And his dad comes out and he says, dude, I don't know why you're even out here. Like, why don't you go out there? Why don't you go in there and spend the rest of the afternoon with the ladies, right? Pointing to the inside of the house. And I look at that and I think that occurred when he was 10 years old, 40 years before I asked him the question. And he still remembered the size of the wrench. And he still remembered the line, why don't you go in there and hang out with the ladies? Michael Jordan spent the rest of his life trying to get his dad to say, good job. He would tell me that he'd never shared that before.
That's
in
incredible.
Any conversation.
What was the moment? What was the thing that you did? You kind of said it. When did you win the right to hear that story?
When he recognized that I had identified something that was not typically a point of his conversation. And then when I made the point of connection to show that we had this little thing in common, that we both struggled to try to find that line to affection, you know, that line of a relationship with a father that we both wish we had, By the way, if I don't do those two things, I can't ask that question.
There's like this frame breaking moment almost. Like when you showed him credible evidence that Don's different, right? Oh, this guy's different. This is not just another reporter asking kind of the standard questions. And again, it's a sort of, but it's not just different in any direction. It's different in a more human connection, perhaps. I don't want to overanalyze it or put words in your mouth, but there's this moment like, oh, this guy gets me. I think, Jordan's like, this guy kind of gets me.
And if you think about it, it's hard for Michael Jordan to say, this guy gets me, right?
Well, I'm sure he did say it. Totally,
but
right?
You know what I mean? But to your point, Brent, I think you're right. But, you know, he would never say, this guy gets me.
Of course
but
not.
Intellectually, he's probably going, wow, he just opened up to me that he struggled.
Yep.
And that we have this same issue, right? We both couldn't find a way to get our dad's attention. Let me tell him this story.
Totally.
And he tells me a story. And afterward, he literally says, you know what? I have spent a lifetime doing interviews. I've never shared that story before.
And I love everything you're saying. And I feel like, you're right. Unless it, you know, if we're talking about a salesperson or someone who's doing interviews or speaking, we absolutely have to earn that right. And you didn't just connect on a commonality. You did what I call third level connection, which is connecting on values. Because when it's something about our family or something that we deeply care about, cancer, whatever it may be, the level of connection is from the heart. It's not from the head anymore. It's from the heart. And now when I do bring this back to sales and I'm thinking, okay, we've got a large, probably sales leader audience, salesperson audience.
I thought our audience was zero right now.
Right. But we're thinking that this is so poignant that it's going to
spike a large
to a
zero.
Billion by next week.
It really
it's a large zero.
It's huge. You've never seen anything like this. But is there not a tendency, and I know it's sort of a leading question because I've seen this so much, is that a salesperson, okay, they're going to use ChatGPT to get all of this information, maybe double check it with Perplexity, check. Okay, I've got all this information about the person. Okay, I'm going to, you know, try to find this personal connection. And it's almost like, how do they not go there too soon and actually undo everything that they're trying to create, actually lose trust because you just gave, it was too much too fast. You tried to sell me software and now you're talking about my dad.
I will tell you, I think a lot of that just requires gut instinct, right? Some of that, I mean, you have to read rooms, you have to read people, you have to read conversations and that requires a little bit of experience, right? Hopefully you get better at it over time. But secondly, I think what it makes is it really is driven by an attentiveness, right? Are you paying? Because no, I couldn't have opened my time with Michael Jordan with that, right? It was in the flow. Right. We're talking. Hey, by the way, I want to talk to you about your dad. I know, you know, blah, blah, blah. Right. And it has to be in the flow and it can't be abrupt. It can't be, a big piece. But at the end of the day, if you're really trying to sell me that piece of software, so is the guy that I met with before and the guy I'm going to meet with after. And if you're busy trying to sell the qualities of your software, trust me, they are on either end of you doing the same thing. What will make you stand out? And what makes you stand out is a willingness to have proven that, A, you did a little research and you knew something about the person that maybe neither person on the other end did. And B, maybe you found something that you had in common and that you can, and it doesn't have to be as dramatic as having a father that you struggled with, right? It could be that you both love, you know, fly fishing, right? Whatever it is, looking, you know, trying to build those concentric circles is a real key to me in what allows for good storytelling, good relationship building. And, the number of times I'm doing a pre-call for a speech, I mean, you know, look, I just did one a few minutes ago, right? And I had all these notes, but I mean, I have the person's full bio because I didn't just pull it off of LinkedIn. I also went on and read bio things. And so I'm able to talk to him about, you know, hey, well, I saw you went to University of North Florida. And I mean, you know, and that surprises people amazingly in this day and age. It still surprises people.
It's digging deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper. And it sounds like asking the questions that nobody else would even think to ask. And I remember when we did an interview for NSA, you said something that blew my mind about your own podcast, which was just like, who does this? But you were saying, and I don't remember who it was you were talking to, but you were talking to somebody and you were asking them about their coach, you know, like their middle school coach that had a huge impact on them. Because of course, your podcast is all about this correlation, which I also find fascinating, that so many C-suite executives, and particularly women, were athletes when they were in college, like something like 92%, yep. I think you said. Yep. But what you said that really stuck with me is that when you were doing research and you asked somebody a question that nobody had asked, and I believe that question was, you know, you had this coach from middle school, but you actually talked to the coach before the podcast. So you not only found out the information, then you took the time to talk to the coach. And then I'm thinking, like, how many salespeople actually like talk to the customer's customer, right? Or how many salespeople would go that far out of their way? And yet it almost feels like that's part of your secret sauce, but it doesn't feel like a technique to me, Don. It feels like you've got this insatiable curiosity about humans. And I guess I'd like to understand, where does that come from?
I would tell you, I think it is a, it's something that grew through my chosen profession, right? I mean, my job as a journalist over the years was to understand people. And it wasn't necessarily to understand stories. It was to understand people. And what I always realized was that all of us have a surface layer. And that's, you know, we made a reference to that earlier, right? It's often what we place out on social media. It's, you know, it's, and everybody on social media is either unbelievably good. Here we are on the, you know, the beaches of Monaco, right? You know, waiting for the race to begin, you know, aren't I awesome? Or it's, you know, boy, my life is a disaster. I've got this challenge or that challenge, or my kids are going through this. That's what social media is, right? It's a complete, but that unfortunately is the way most people kind of believe they should live their life, right? They want to be either one or the other. The truth is, I believe there's always that layer that if I can try to get to that next layer, whatever it might be, I'll understand them. And if I understand them, then I'll understand why they did what they did. If I understand why they did what they did, maybe there's a whole different picture that can be painted. And my desire as a journalist was always that. And then it became my desire as an author and my desire as a speaker and my desire as a podcast host. I want to go next level. And if I can do that in everything I do, I think ultimately things will work out for me.
I've been wondering this a lot, and I think you're the perfect person to ask this of. And I'm not trying to catch you out. I'm legitimately just curious how this works for all of us, including maybe you, because you write about greatness, you write about leadership, and you interview incredible people who have had incredible careers, and you find the darkness. You mentioned Dion and Michael Jordan as well. But even just listening to your answer for yourself on that, which is, I've just been curious since I was a kid. It's like, what if I'm listening to this thinking, okay, all right, I've been listening to this guy. These guys are helping me figure out how to make better connections and approach customers and understand and do this research. And now I have to be curious. I just don't care. You know, I'm just not that curious. Or like, it's good for Don. So he's been curious since he was a kid. I'm just not that guy. So that, you know, it goes back to this point about greatness. It's like, good for Michael Jordan, but I can't do that. Do you think about this a lot or not?
I've thought about it because some people have said that to me, like, you know what, boy, I couldn't do what you do. And I'm going, I disagree. Like but again, it's because how I'm wired. I mean, I think in story, I listen to people and I reduce their story to 60 seconds. I probably things that you guys do. And I argue that if you really are not curious about other people, the opportunity you have to really do something special with them. And that if that's something special, sell them the biggest order you've ever sold. I mean, if you're okay to sell them a pencil, good. You probably don't need to know much about them other than you might want to ask why they're not using a pen. But sorry, that's the curious in me, right?
No, it's good. By the way, I think this works for marriage too in a thousand other contexts, right? It's kind of a life lesson, isn't it? But
It is.
And what comes up for me as I'm thinking about this, as my dad always taught me, you know, we have to practice curiosity, empathy, and patience like we practice a sport or an instrument. And you can't just say, well, I'm not a curious person any more than Jordan could have said when he was 12, I'm not a basketball player. I don't know how to dribble. We have to, if we want to develop curiosity, then guess what? We can't have different versions of ourselves. Then I'm going to develop it with my child. I'm going to listen better. I'm going to, in my community,
ask a question.
I have to practice it.
Right. Yeah. It is not, I mean, I think someone saying I'm not curious is a cop-out. I think all of us, innately, we want to know something about people, right? We want to know. I think, you know, you don't go on a date and not want to know. If you go on a date and all you went for was to talk about yourself.
Oh no, I've been on plenty of those, Don. Trust me, that was the last date we went on.
Don, do you not date?
No, you have no idea what guys do in the dating world. It's been a while for you, I know.
Enough about me. Now you talk about me, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh God,
I'm tired of talking about me. Would you repeat some of it, please?
Right, exactly.
No, I mean, if you really are not curious, then you're going to live a very lonely life. I really do believe that. And so, if somebody gives me that answer, and I have said this, I just say it's a cop out. Like I think you're looking for a way not. But by the way, be happy where you are because you will never be where others are. And because others have figured this out, right? This is the ultimate in human nature is looking for an opportunity to kind of create some kind of a bond with others. And you do so by being observant and by asking questions. And when you do those things, you open doors that you might never have imagined opened.
On that point, Dan, let me ask you, as you go through your sort of, I guess, circles is how you put them, right? So the concentric circles of getting to a place where you make this human connection.
I was going to go concentric squares, but they didn't really work that well.
But then there's similar squares. I don't know. But anyway, but let me ask you, at the center of this, here's how, because there's something about what you do and a little bit of what I do, and certainly what sellers do that's really interesting, is there's this asymmetry in these relationships. And that is by no means diminishing you, but some of the people you talk, Condoleezza Rice, I mean, or Michael Jordan, I mean, some of the people you're talking to, at least society puts them on a pretty high pedestal of importance. And then you're well-known author, Don Yeager, but you're not Michael Jordan. You know what I mean? And so it is very, and I, again, no offense at all to you in bad respect.
No, by the way, I think I know where your question's going.
Yeah.
I can't wait.
Because it's similar to a salesperson, particularly a younger salesperson. When I speak to college students who are 21, 22, and they're about to go call on vice presidents of some big bank, right? Or a senior, they're going to be in the boardroom of some organization there, and they're really freaked out about this asymmetry of information. And so for me, one of these last steps that I sort of engage in personally when I go into one of these conversations is a mindset. And the mindset step is to remind myself, they're a human being like you are. And this human being has the context of power, but they also have the context of just humanity, of an experience with their father, of a cancer survivor, of whatever it might be. And there's room for us to connect, even when the reporting chart or whatever says that there isn't. Do you do that consciously as well?
So I actually, I talk about this often, that when that the upside of doing these concentric circles.
Yeah.
Is it levels the playing field.
Yeah.
Remember, I said to you before, Michael Jordan, I will never have Michael Jordan's skill.
Right.
But I have this one little thing in common with him, right? We both struggled with our relationship that we desperately wanted to be better, and neither one of us could figure out how to turn the corner, right? And so I believe that when you do the right research and then you find the right common ground, everything comes down to level, right? Now they are no longer the vice president of some big organization and I'm a 21-year-old salesperson. Now we're actually two peers in a conversation. We're two people in a conversation. Your business card and mine are completely irrelevant. And so I think that that's the beauty of that concept, is that it because it's true. I mean, let's be honest, right? If you're a speaker, people look at you, you're up there on a stage, I'm down here. You're a salesperson, they're the seller or they're the buyer, they're up there and I'm down here. The truth is, when we do this right, we level set, and it's and the game changes. The game changes.
I'd love to just go somewhere with John Wooden here, because I know that John Wooden became your mentor. And I'm thinking of when John Wooden became your mentor and you asked John Wooden to be your mentor, because I don't know the whole story. Were you Don Yeager yet?
Mm-mm. I was a writer at Sports Illustrated, but I was, I was a journalist, and I don't know what it means to be Don Yeager, but I was Don Yeager then. I was actually Don Yeager a long time before that, but I actually was not, maybe if what you're referring to is, had I achieved some level of success?
Exactly.
I was at Sports Illustrated, but in my profession, kind of a good deal, but I hadn't written a bunch of best-selling books. I hadn't done all these other things. If that's the way we're framing it, I had not yet really gotten there. No.
How does he become your mentor? How does John Wooden, what happened?
I'll tell you the backstory real quick and it'll explain it. I was at SI. One of my best friends is was a basketball coach at Louisiana State. His number one pupil was a basketball player named Shaquille O'Neal. Shaq had gone to the Los Angeles Lakers and was playing for the Lakers. And I'd heard through my friend that Shaq was going out every month to spend part of an afternoon with John Wooden. And I asked, well, what were they doing? And he's, well, John Wooden has become his mentor. And I thought, here's 26-year-old Shaq, 88-year-old John Wooden, outside of basketball, like they have nothing in common, really. You know, Shaq is making bad movies like Kazam, and, John Wooden wouldn't even watch a bad movie like Kazam. So I asked for permission. Could I come one day when you two are together? They agreed. They granted me that opportunity. I sat there, and for 3 hours, they never once talked about basketball. Shaq was asking questions about how to be a better father, how to be a better husband, how to be a better man, how to be a better leader, better teammate. He had all these questions. He'd written them down. Like, he was well prepared for this opportunity with this icon, John Wooden. So the session's coming to an end. I get up. I said, Coach Wooden, that was magical, watching your influence on this young man. But I just got to ask, like, how does somebody become mentored by John Wooden? And he looked at me and he said, you ask. And I said, well, gosh, how many people ask? And he said, not as many as you might think. He said, most people walk themselves out of most opportunities to be mentored by someone because they fail to ask. I was like, wow. So I go away, write this little story, reach back to Coach Wooden. I asked him if he read it. He did. He was very kind. And I said, Coach, as I was standing there, I felt like I was supposed to ask. And he said, what took you so long? And we started there and went for 12 years.
Well,
every other month.
Years.
Every other month, I would fly to California for a day with Coach Wooden.
And he was 88 at the time. Was it 12? Was he 100? So tell me the how. So
he was 99. He was 99 and a half when he died. I met with him. Well, I wasn't counting on you doing the math right, so I was doing it for you. But
yeah, thank you. Probably good. Yeah, I told you I'm from Omaha. You know, there's so many lessons in there. But if I could, Don, I'd love to just take the whole thing and flip it for just a moment, because you also write a lot about leadership and just something you said about, when people come up to me and I'm a speaker, I'm a stage, I'm a writer, and we still find a way to make a human connection. When I think back to sort of myself in that situation, I often will tell people, I'm just a schlub from Omaha, which is, by the way, true. I'm just a schlub from Omaha, right? So what I'm trying to do is also bring myself down a notch to make myself more accessible. I'm wondering if it's, do you see it as almost, I don't know, incumbent, but at least an opportunity for leaders, because you talk so much about leadership, you talk to leaders, an opportunity for them, and almost maybe even a responsibility for them to also manage this asymmetry, as opposed to just, you know, leave it to this person down here to try to find their way to connect up. Does that make sense? Yeah.
Totally agree. I have a podcast that's coming out here soon with the CEO of Denny's, right?
Yeah.
The restaurant chain.
Yeah.
And she decided several years ago to open up and tell her employee base that she was adopted. And it took her till she was 47 to find her adoptive parents. And she told the story of what it was like to find these parents that had given her up for adoption when they were both young teenagers. And she made that choice because she wanted to say, don't think of me as CEO, think of me as somebody who has a life story.
Yeah.
And out of that, she said, and on the interview, out of that, she started having employees walk up and say, thank you for sharing your story. Do you mind if I share mine? And so by it doesn't have to be, you know, I mean, Brent, I get it. You're a schmo from Omaha. And I mean, I could see that in you.
We wear it on our sleeves.
It doesn't have to be, something self-deprecating like that. Sometimes it can literally just be sharing a little bit about who you are, right?
Yeah.
Sometimes it's just you open the door for others to find relational moments with you if you're willing to just share a little bit about who you are.
Make yourself accessible. You know, I'm 56 now, so I don't know if I'm at the end of my career, but I'm in the back nine, right? And the thing that I can say, Don, I would imagine in your case with all the people you've talked to and interact with, and thousands of them, I can honestly say that some of my best friends today started out as clients in these sort of asymmetrical relationships. And I think in some ways, it's because they were, just as much as I tried very hard to make that connection and sort of overcome asymmetry from my side, is that they were willing to do the same from theirs. And that it's turned into just a really beautiful thing. And it always becomes like this way to almost think about, in sales, we always talk about sort of opportunity qualification, who's worth my time. But there's also just from a personal standpoint, like who's worth my time is someone who's willing to think that I'm worth their time. Is that fair?
That's a really good line. That's a great line.
Now, you know, your phone's going to blow up right now, Don, because everybody's going to say, will you be my mentor? Will you be my mentor? Will you be my mentor? I just wanted to ask. You know, that's about to happen. But thank you for trusting us with our huge audience. And the more I get to talk to you, the more it just makes me not look at who I am as a seller or a leader, but who I am as a human and what matters. And it just always gets me back to my roots of not what I need to do, but who I need to be. Mm. And I think that's really what I got out of this, is it's not so much ever what you do, it's who you need to be while you're doing it. And thank you for that. I think people would like to know, I've got two more questions for you. We know that selling isn't everything, Brent, but it's something, right? So what is that something for you in all of this? What does it mean?
The something for me is selling for me is influence, right? It's if I sell myself as a speaker and I'm successful at it, I have an opportunity to influence more people. I have an opportunity to be in their universe for a period of time. If I sell myself right properly enough as a writer, I sell more books. If I sell more books, I get a chance to write more books. And so selling for me is an opportunity to just increase my opportunities. It's just an opportunity to increase my opportunities. And if I can, so I focus on selling because I want the chance to have more influence, because I want the chance to have more opportunity, because I want to teach storytelling again next week. You know, I do it so that I get a chance to do more of it. And So it might not be everything, but it is important.
And Don, how does our huge audience get a hold of you for keynotes?
Well, I don't want them all to do it at once.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it could get a little crazy.
Because we could bust the internet, we blow the internet, right? If they all.
And I know you're already booking out. I actually do know that you're already booking out for Q1 of next year, because I know a couple of people are hiring you. But how do people get a hold of you for your wealth of knowledge and wisdom?
It's just the easiest is just donyeager.com. And by the way, my last name is Y-A-E-G-E-R. But knowing that most people misspell it, I also own all the other spellings of my name on the internet, and they all direct you to the right place. So you can botch my name and you'll likely still find me.
Do you own the J-A-Umlaut? G-E-R?
Is it like Jägermeister? How's Jägermeister spelled?
Jägermeister's J-A-G-E-R-M-E-I-S-T-E-R.
It's been a while. So.
Yeah, I told you, Sherry, well, Jäger is German for hunter. So I don't know if you own Don Hunter or not, but that would be actually really cool. That'd be like next level.
Don the Hunter. No, but I did, in fact, I used to own a comedy club, and I owned a sports bar that was attached to it, and it was called Meister Jäger's Sports Bar.
So. Nice. All right, let's do that on episode when we bring you back for our...
On episode 250, when we have 10 people listening.
And I want to hear about the sports club comedy bar. Yeah, we'll talk about that. Don, thank you so much for joining
us. Thank you so much, Don.
Nice to meet you.
Thanks. I love you guys.
Cheers.